The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post, and we're going to be reading some of their By the Way travel sections. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to hear about how time and distance can connect us in sometimes surprising ways. Travel's not always about going from point A to point B. I mean, it may basically be that, but it can also be about pressing the go button following a long pause in time, using genealogy and other connector tools to fill in missing links. Our first example is old African-American cemetery yields DNA links to 41,000 new relatives. This article, co-written by Michael Ruin and Carolyn Y. Johnson and Earl Yarber, of the Washington Post. The article published in the August 5th, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer and originally written for the Post. Scientists said Thursday, August 3rd, that they have found more than 41,000 genetic relatives of 27 enslaved people who were buried in Maryland's Catoctin Furnace African American Cemetery about 220 years ago. Experts from Harvard University and the Smithsonian Institution said the discovery showcased a new research approach that could be invaluable to people seeking clues about long-lost ancestors. And, of course, more information about certain destinations. The method could be especially vital for African Americans, whose lineages were often destroyed by generations of enslavement and whose family histories went unrecorded, the scientists said in a study published in the journal Science. It is the latest in a series of efforts supported by black communities that use technology to examine burials of enslaved people to fill in the yawning gaps in African American history. Similar efforts are underway at sites in Williamsburg, Virginia, St. Mary's, Maryland, and Charleston, South Carolina. In the Catoctin Furnace case, DNA was recently obtained from the bones of 27 people, 11 genetically female and 16 genetically male, exhumed from the cemetery 40 years ago to make way for a road project. An enslaved workforce of several hundred toiled at the iron-making site north of Frederick in the late 1700s and early 1800s. Their DNA was then compared with that of 9 million people in the vast database of 23andMe, the California genetic firm that people use to have their genomes analyzed for health and ancestry information. That group of participants consents to having their data used anonymously in research, and their identities are not known to the researchers. The 41,799 people can be contacted in theory, said Adine Harney, a population geneticist at 23andMe and the lead author of the study. We are considering a way to thoughtfully and ethically return results to those in the 23andMe database who would like to know if they are connected to the Catoctin Furnace individuals, company spokesman Andy Kill said in an email. Raquel Flesk, an assistant professor of anthropology at Dartmouth College, who also works with historical DNA, said it's a remarkable paper. However, it leads to a lot of questions regarding how do we open this Pandora's box. The study noted that the vast majority of the genetic relatives are not direct descendants of the Catoctin individuals. Most connections are likely between collateral relatives who descend from a common ancestor who lived generations before the Catoctin individuals and may not have lived in America. But almost 3,000 people were found to be close relatives akin to a great-great-great-grandchild or a first cousin six times removed, Harvard said in a press release. And the highest concentrations of close relatives, a total of 30, was in Maryland, suggesting that the Catoctin descendants and their relatives stayed in or returned there after emancipation, the study said. I'm astonished, said Vicki L. Winston, 65, of Kearneysville, West Virginia, who is the great-great-great-granddaughter of Hanson Summers, who was enslaved at the furnace. He does not appear to be associated with the cemetery burials. Summers died in 1899. It's just overwhelming to see how far back they can go, she said. It's just a coming together like it was supposed to be. I'm just waiting to see how close we can get. Winston's connection to her enslaved ancestor was established in 2022 via old-fashioned genealogical sleuthing. Harvard said this was the first time ancient DNA technology was used with giant genetic database for research. The study found that the Catoctin dead had ties to Africa, specifically to the Wolof, the Mandinka, the Congo, and Lulawat groups, and to ancestors in Ireland and Britain. The European ancestry largely came from the rape of black women by white men, the report says. The findings are a leap forward, said Douglas Owsley. That's Owsley. He's curator of biological anthropology at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History and one of the paper's authors. This is a transformative process in terms of the ability to follow people's histories back in time, he said. Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. was co-author and consultant on the study. To be an African-American alive at this time when we're experiencing a revolution in the use of genetics to solve genealogical mysteries is a blessing, he said. We are the first generation who now have access to a methodology that helps us break through the proverbial brick wall of the 1870 federal census. Now, before that census, they did not list enslaved African Americans by name, he said. In the past, genealogists had to search the records of white enslavers to learn the stories of the black people they enslaved, Gates said. But now we have another method, said Gates, host of the public television show Finding Your Roots. People may not learn a precise connection to a forgotten ancestor, but at least it's something, he said, whereas before there was nothing. That information was absent. The box was blank. David Reich, a Harvard geneticist who specializes in old DNA and has co-authored the paper, said, I'm very happy about this particular study and the way it was carried out in consultation with a community that was connected in some way to the remains. It is the latest step in a 9-year examination of the site started by Maryland archaeologist Elizabeth A. Comer, president of the Catoctin Furnace Historical Society, and supported by the African American Resources Cultural and Heritage Society of Frederick County. We're finally there, or part of the way there, I should say, Comer said. I'm absolutely elated that we got to this point. Good things take time. I knew it would be a long haul, I just didn't know how long. Comer said she had long dreamed of the possibility of somehow putting names to the anonymous enslaved buried at Catoctin, and this study puts the African-American DNA front and center, she said. 2 years ago, experts unveiled a study that used the same Catoctin DNA to establish family relationships among the cemetery burials. So far, 5 families have been identified. In one family, 2 boys, a newborn and 2-month-old, were buried on either side of their mother, who was about 22 when she died. Some distance away, another relative of hers, a boy about 10, was buried. Their exact relationship is unclear. Another consisted of a mother, her infant son, and the mother's sibling. Yet another family was a boy about 4 and his sister, who was about 2. The project also created facial reconstructions of 2 people whose remains were removed from the cemetery, one a woman in her 30s who experts think may have died in childbirth, the other a teenager with a damaged spine. The faces are based on copies of the original skulls held at the Smithsonian. The investigation began when Comer, who grew up on a farm near Catoctin, suggested to the Smithsonian that it re-examine the cemetery bones that had come to the National Museum of Natural History in 1979 and 1980. They had been taken from the site when nearby Route 15 was being expanded. More than half of the cemetery graves were removed. Dozens more are still there. Signs of the toxic and backbreaking work the enslaved people had to do at the primitive ironmaking site emerged. One older man's back was so severely bent that it had to be broken to get him into his grave, experts said. Another man's bones had extremely high levels of zinc, probably from having to clean deposits from the inside of the furnace, suggesting he may have had fume fever as a result, the experts said. Indications of sickle cell disease and inherited blood disorder that mainly affects African Americans were found, along with abnormalities of the skull. Catoctin Furnace was in operation from about 1776 until 1903, Comer said. Large deposits of iron ore had been discovered nearby, and the furnace was built to process iron into pig iron. It was one of 65 iron works in Maryland and Virginia, which usually used about 70 enslaved and free workers. The work was hard and dirty. The ore had to be dug out, washed, and transported in carts to the furnace. Huge numbers of trees had to be cut down and burned in specially built mounds by colliers to make charcoal, which was hauled to the furnace for fuel. Catoctin required a roughly an acre of hardwood for every 24 hours of operation, according to the book Catoctin Furnace, Portrait of an Iron-Making Village by Elizabeth Yorty Anderson. Limestone also had to be acquired to reduce impurities during the process. The ore, charcoal, and limestone were all dumped into the top of the furnace stack, heated with the aid of a water-powered bellows until the ore became molten and could be tapped. Once in operation, the furnace could run nonstop for months, at night casting an eerie glow over the landscape. Three generations of people were enslaved there, Comer has said. Some may have been brought there because of iron-making skills learned in Africa. A diary of a clergyman who ministered to the enslaved people showed they would gather chestnuts to sell, Comer said. Sometimes they managed to escape. In 1782, a newspaper printed an ad offering a reward for two men who had fled. Both were much pitted by smallpox, the ad said. The furnace owner offered a reward of £3 each for their recapture. Catoctin used an enslaved workforce until the 1830s or 40s, when European immigrants began to supplant them, Comer said. By the 1840s, the Catoctin African or Furnace African community is non-existent, Owsley of the Smithsonian has said. What happened to these folks? Where did they go? Were they sold out of the community? Were they sold downriver? When Catoctin's enslaved disappeared, they left behind their dead with simple field stones marking their graves amid the poisonous bloodroot flower in the cemetery underbrush. Next, we have the story of farmers found jet wreckage, spent 11 years looking for family. This is written by Jonathan Edwards for the Washington Post, and the article appeared in the July 21, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. And it has a photo caption here. It says, Bill Knobb, who is shown in this picture with his brother Dave, posed for a photo on May 28th holding a metal piece of their father's F-80 Shooting Star, which crashed in 1958. Bill Knobb was dozing off one afternoon in late May when his phone roused him to attention. Despite not recognizing the number, he answered the call. A stranger asked if he was related to Major William R. Hodgson, an Air Force Guard fighter pilot, or Air National Guard fighter pilot, who died in a jet crash 65 years earlier at the age of 36. Yes, said Knobb, 71. I'm his son. With that, the stranger on the other end of the line, Colette Jessen, solved an 11-year-old mystery that had been vexing her ever since she and her husband purchased a roughly 160-acre property in Perkins County, Nebraska, in 2012. While clearing the land to plant crops, Jessen's husband stumbled upon a hole in which someone had buried a chunk of metal. Unearthing it, he found a 4-foot-long piece of aluminum, a memorial engraved with its origin story. Major William Hodgson crashed with F-80 jet February 26, 1958. Jessen, 59, decided to track down Hodgson's descendants so she could give it to them. What she didn't know was that in doing so, she was committing to an odyssey that would last more than a decade. Whoever this family was or next of kin, they needed that piece, Jensen said. I was not ever going to throw it away. I just needed to find them. On February 26, 1958, Hodgson was flying a training mission for the Colorado Air National Guard. On his way from Denver to Rome, New York, his F-80 Shooting Star jet fighter exploded and crashed outside of Grant, Nebraska. That's about 15 miles east of the Colorado state line. For 54 years, the aluminum memorial lay buried until Jessen and her husband, both farmers, purchased the property at an estate sale. Within a month, her husband was out on a tractor clearing the land. That's when he came across the metal debris, which they later would learn was a piece of the wreckage that had been engraved as a tribute to Hodgson after the crash. Jessen first turned to the Internet looking for the Hodgsons in the area in Denver and as far away as Wyoming. Many calls went unanswered and voicemail requests for return calls unheeded. When Hodgson did pick up, it was never the right one. Then, Jessen would forget about her pet project. A year or so later, she picked it up again with similar results. The cycle repeated itself for years. Jessen first turned to the Internet, as we said, and then a pandemic hit, and Jessen, like a lot of people, found herself trapped at home with time on her hands. She tried a new strategy, contacting the military installation in Aurora, Colorado, where Hodgson's flight originated. Those efforts also failed. In August 2021, she turned to Perkins County Veterans Service representative, who said she could help. That summer, and again in March 2022, the representative posted a message in the Investigation Connection. That's a Facebook group of more than 150,000 members dedicated in part to reuniting old photos and other mementos with their owners or family members. About a year later, volunteer researcher Sherry Hancock, 66, saw the message when she joined the group. Hancock, who's been doing informal investigative work for about 5 years, has an affinity for reunited military paraphernalia with owners and their relatives. The piece of wreckage from Hodgson's plane stood out. "I knew right away I had to help this family," she said. Hancock enlisted the help of her friend Susan Sanju, who also gravitates toward military items. Using census records, old newspaper articles, marriage certificates, and divorce decrees, Sanju found that the nugget that cracked the case. She discovered that Hodgson's widow had gotten remarried to a man named Clement Knob. Her new husband adopted the 5 Hodgson children who took the name Knob, which meant that Jessen had been barking up the wrong tree for more than a decade. The new info ultimately allowed Jessen to call Bill Knob at his Denver home about a week before Memorial Day. That call came right as Knob was drifting off for his usual afternoon nap. After confirming that Knob was Hodgson's son, Jessen launched into the story about finding the plane debris and spending more than a decade trying to track him down. "Immediately I said, I'll come and get it. Where is it?" Knob said, because all of a sudden this brought back a lot of memories of that fatal day and everything that's happened over the last 65 years. On May 28th, Knob and his younger brother Dave drove 4.5 hours from Denver to Grant, meeting Jessen and her husband at a cemetery the Jessens were helping to set up for the Memorial Day ceremony. Well, they talked about everything, the crash, the brothers' memories of their father, the discovery of the debris, and the search for the Knobs. Then Jessen asked if they wanted to see the site where her husband had found the wreckage. They drove 25 miles to see the place where their dad had died more than 65 years earlier. The Knob brothers stayed for the city's Memorial Day service the next day. Veterans were there. Taps played. Some of the dignitaries who gave speeches about honor and sacrifice mentioned the Knob's father. When they drove back to Denver the next day, one mystery remained. Who had engraved the details of their father's crash on a piece of the wreckage? They theorized that his aviator buddies had buried it as a way to honor their friend and fellow pilot. But as the story spread over the following days, other information emerged, including from Phyllis Peak, whose father, in 1958, owned the land where Hodgson crashed, Jessen said. Peak, age 84, said that she remembered her father had heard the crash, rushed out to the wreckage, and called emergency services. After emergency crews left and the situation calmed, her father camped at the crash site for a week to guard it against thieves out to snatch pieces of the wreckage. It was Peak's father who engraved details about Hodgson's and the crash on the piece of aluminum and then buried it on his land. He planted it there as a memorial, Knob said. Knob and his brother were already back home when they learned about Peak and her father, but said they planned to return to Nebraska to meet her and learn more about her father, with whom they are now forever connected. By engraving a piece of the wreckage and burying it at the crash site, he honored Hodgson, Knob said, and by unearthing it and making sure it got to Hodgson's children, Jessen honored Peak's father, too. For Knob, it brought about a flood of emotions and memories of his father, such as those of the two of them fishing together when he was a boy. He said the wings over the Rockies Air and Space Museum in Colorado has expressed interest in creating an exhibit about his father with the engraved piece of wreckage at the center, as the centerpiece. Hodgson started flying in 1940 as a civilian pilot in Utica, New York, near his hometown. He went on to serve as a Marine Corps pilot in World War II in Korea before joining the Air National Guard, his son said. It's resurrected the story of his father, his military service, and his sacrifice, Knob said. 65 years later, it comes back into full view of everybody, and everybody loved to hear it, Knob said. My father's still living, in a way. Well, we're going to end our journey with today's Armchair Traveler story of the last of the Thames barges race to save British maritime history. Now, this story is about a tradition that dates back to the 1860s when men took pride and pleasure in sailing barges along a famous English waterway. Washington Post writer William Booth's article appeared in the July 31, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer, and the dateline is Gravesend, England, and there is a photo with a caption that I'll read first. The barge Niagara can be seen from the deck of the Wivenhoe, or Wivenhoe, I should say, on race day for the Thames Sailing Barge Match. The Thames River barges are like 100-year-old bathtubs with sails, according to their crews, and they drink tea during the race. How British. Here we go. One of the oldest sailing races in the world is the America's Cup. Right behind it's the Thames Sailing Barge Match. The America's Cup competitors race $10 million space-age hydrofoils that are so fast their crews are required to wear helmets. Now, the Thames barges are like 100-year-old bathtubs with sails, according to their crews, who drink tea during the race. The barge skippers are highly competitive in their own way, but their race is now largely about the preservation of British tradition. Recalling a time when thousands of these craft plied the River Thames, transporting cargo, coal, barley, rubbish, under red ochre sails. Only a couple of dozen barges survive on a clammy Saturday this month. That would be July 2023. Eight of those barges appeared in the early morning haze, ghost of the maritime past, but real. They cast off from Gravesend, a Thames-side town that boasts the oldest remaining cast-iron pier in the world and was once a mustering point of British imperial sea power, but today not so much. Some of the barge skippers cranked up their auxiliary diesels to hurry to the starting line 4 miles downriver. Others have no engine, so they coasted along. The brawny boats looked like what they were, hard workers. They were designed to ferry enormous loads in their holds up and down the Thames and its nearby rivers and estuaries, in shallow, shoaling waters, subject to notorious tides and nervous wind. With their flat-bottom hulls steadied by lee boards instead of a keel, the barges could be easily settled into the shoreside mud on a low tide for loading and unloading. While they were in trade, they hauled brick, cement, timber, sand, coal, grain, and gunpowder. They ran barley to Britain's or London's brewers and wheat to its bakers. When the city's transport was dominated by horse and carriage, the barges brought London straw and hauled away manure in what was known as hay up, dung down trade. They were practical boats, but clever, suited to the task, said Richard Walsh, 80, a former owner of the barge Wivenhoe, which was on board, and he was on board that day as a guest for the match. Now, he pointed out the ingenious rigging that makes them among the largest sailing vessels in the world that can be handled by a crew of two, or, as the lore has it, a man, a boy, and a dog, though many were husband and wife teams. The racing made the barges even better, Wall said. The Thames Sailing Barge Match has been running since 1863, with pauses for economic recessions and world wars. It started with a barge owner named Henry Dodd, who made his fortune hauling rubbish, and probably inspired Charles Dickens' character Noddy Boffin, the wealthy London golden dustman in the novel Our Mutual Friend. Dodd noticed that skippers on the river would often try to best each other, and he decided to formalize the competition. According to a historical account by Frank Carr, a one-time director of the Britain's National Maritime Museum, soon the shipyards were playing with hull shapes and sail plans, and barge owners were vying for prize money and boasting rights. In a breeze fresh from the south, the barges are capable of 12 knots or 14 miles per hour. That's nowhere close to America's Cup races, which can do 50 miles per hour, but it's pretty fast for an ordinary sailboat, and nearly as fast as the average cruising speed of a modern container ship. Ease away the sheets, called the Wivenhoe skipper, Gerard Swift, who grew up on a Thames barge in the 1960s. The Wivenhoe had a smart downwind start, and as the barge gathered speed, the skipper at the wheel coaxed her on. Let's go, girl, let's go. The barges were well matched, racing in three classes. They fought each other for the lead. The two barges in the coasting class, Gladys and Pudge, kept up for a day-long tracking duel. The race was supposed to run 43 nautical miles, starting in Lower Hope Reach and heading down river past Southend on the Sea to the North Ouse Buoy before returning to the finish at Gravesend. But as the fleet reached Canvey Island, the already light wind slackened, and the race committee shortened the course. By the time the fleet turned back to the race, the crews were trying to keep up with seaweed that slid past them in the tide. All this was happening amid the narrow confines of navigable waterways, busy with commercial traffic as container ships, sand dredgers, tugboats, and ferries made their way through the race. So as you can see, they don't halt traffic for this. The Thames remains a working river, its low banks by turns, a smudged watercolor of marsh and birds, than the harder angles of the industry. We pass the Tilbury Sewage Treatment Works and the London Gateway, one of the largest ports for container ships in Britain. There are low hills, which are actually landfills, and the shuttered Coryton Oil Refinery, and long ago decommissioned Coal House Fort built in the mid-19th century to protect the estuary from the French. The fort would have witnessed the heyday of the sailing barges. According to the Society for Sailing Barge Research, 4,860 barges were built for the trade from the 18th century to World War I. There may be 8,000 in all, including the smaller vessels that were unregistered. Almost all have been lost, abandoned, or dismantled. A few of the ones still around spent decades of ignominy as houseboats, dockside restaurants. Others have done their turn as corporate training venues. Wivenhoe was made to look like she was blown up in the opening sequence of the James Bond movie The World Is Not Enough. Others took a long nap in the mud before they were revived by enthusiasts. Asked why the modern-day owners are obsessed with the barges and dedicated to keeping them afloat and racing, Wall said, "We British have salt in our veins." He mentioned that the barges preserved the maritime tradition on this island nation. Walsh thought maybe the barges had something to teach the world, that cargo could still be moved by wind. "Why don't we do it again?" he said. "Maybe we could save the planet." The cost of restoring and preserving the sailing barges is beyond the means of most patrons. Some of the boats have continued to deteriorate while fundraising efforts languish. Walsh named 9 barges in recent years broken up for scrap: Felix, Scone, Vigilant, Venture. Among those that have benefited from public money is Pudge, a veteran of the little boat evacuation of Dunkirk, France, in the early days of World War II. The barge was towed across the English Channel at night and near the French beaches encountered an explosion that lifted her out of the water, according to the records maintained by the Thames Sailing Barge Trust. "She came down to the right way up," the skipper continued, "and the budge helped save the lives of 160 soldiers." There was nothing quite so dramatic on this most recent match day. Toward the end of the race, the wind finally filled in and the barges made pace. The finish line was Three Dawes Pub, serving the waterfront trade since the 1450s. Wivenhoe finished second in her class. Jim Dines, her owner, who had been roving fore and aft all day, finally had a moment to talk. He joked that he works to keep the boat afloat. And there, my friends, ends today's journey of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and remind you, the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.